You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show. Today on the James Altucher Show.
Such a pleasure to talk to Jason Harris, who wrote the book, The Soulful Art of Persuasion. He has a completely different approach to it than all the so-called experts on persuasion. I learned a lot. These techniques work. I really related to a lot of the techniques, and I know for a fact they work. Listen to this podcast closely. Jason Harris, the author of The Soulful Art of Persuasion, The 11 Habits That Will Make Anyone a Master Influencer. Let's talk about The Soulful Art of Persuasion. By Jason Harris. This is a great book because normally you see books about persuasion where it's like, oh, if you cross your legs, and then everybody else crosses their legs and they start obeying your every command. And I just think that academic research is just bullshit. And the stuff you say here really resonates with me, in particular, the relationship between storytelling and persuasion. And no one's pointed this out except you, among other things in the book, but persuasion and skill development, which I thought was very interesting. And that's really true. But maybe we could start with, oh, and look, you got Ryan Holiday on the back, Lewis Howes on the back. You think you had me on the back?
Well, I always wanted to meet you, and now I'm meeting you.
Now, next book, you'll get me on the
next
back.
Next book, next book. But by the way, speaking of next book, before we talk about this book, I had two book ideas for my next book floating around. One of them I can't do anymore because I got your email yesterday, Life Advice from People Over 100.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to write a whole book about people on their way out and what advice they had for people on how to live. Cool though. I love that idea.
You hear about someone who's over 100, like what advice do they have? It's like people who are married over 30 years and people who are over 100, two categories of probably the most miserable people on the planet. And yet we're always asking them for a lot of advice.
So I'm in advertising. You were in the space. The way I build a successful company that's independent, no investors, you know, we're $50 million a year in revenue.
That's great.
Totally bootstrapped. You know, it took a long time, obviously. But I remember reading a Gallup poll that said, you know, what are the most dishonest professions in America? And number one was politicians, which you would expect, right?
Yeah.
Number two was car salesmen. And then number three was advertising practitioners. And I thought, well, that's pretty shitty that people think our business is so dishonest. And so I sort of thought, well, I build a successful advertising business by persuading people to hire us and then persuading consumers to react to the ads that we put out there to move units. And I've done that through what I think is a more soulful networking, relationship building way that isn't shady or predicated on fooling people or persuasion that's about mirror and matching. And like you were saying, you know, it's not about like, well, if this guy likes golf, then I'll play golf. Or if she loves chess, then I'll learn chess and become a good chess player. So I felt like I had something to offer in a way that I built my business, which I think was more authentic and true. And it seemed like the right time for this book to come out because we're living in such a bifurcated culture. And I felt like this is a more true way to be an entrepreneur.
And I want to add that this book also is not just for persuading as an organization, or how to get your company to persuade more customers. I really resonated with this on an individual level. Like, persuasion has like a bad rap to it. Like, you have to be inauthentic to persuade someone of something, which I think is a real scarcity way of thinking. Why can't you be who you are and then people like you enough to be persuaded by what you say? And you address this, it's the second to last chapter or third to last chapter. You reference Tim Ferriss learning a new skill every year. But yeah. if you begin the process of mastering a skill, it adds a new competence to your demeanor. People could see the competence. And I think people do listen to people who know what it is to work hard and improve at something and learn something difficult. And it's the package that makes you that's persuasive, not some techniques or tricks.
Yeah, it's also being an original, being yourself, totally being yourself. Everyone else has already taken the Oscar Wilde quote, famous Oscar Wilde quote, that your uniqueness and your idiosyncrasies, that's what makes other people gravitate towards you.
Or it's hate me, in my case.
Well, no, I mean, you've built a successful career by being yourself.
You know? Yeah, no,
not
that's true.
Not trying to be anyone else. That's why you have a persona, and you wrote a lot of books, and you've got a podcast, and invested in a lot of different things because people understand who you are. You have an identity, and you're always who you are.
But sometimes when you say, particularly when you say, hey, if you want to be more persuasive, you got to be who you are. There's a fine line there. Like, I could almost picture people taking notes. Okay, right, yeah, be who I am. So it's almost like then they're not going to be who they are because they're thinking that's something, another task they have to perform. Okay, I got to put this in the be who I am
category.
Yeah.
It is a task, actually. Like, learning who you are is a task, and there's ways to do that, you know, writing down your value system, the things you care about, the things that interest you, your passions, and going to explore those passions. It is a task, and it's probably the most important task. Figuring out who your role models are, who you want to emulate, and studying them. It does take work to be who you are, actually.
That technique, it's mentioned also in Todd Herman's book, The Alter Ego Effect. The idea of finding the people you really look up to, emulate, almost like virtual mentors. This is a real worthwhile technique for finding out who you are, because who excites you, the people who inspire you, they're triggering something that's real inside of you. Not like, oh, I need to be like John D. Rockefeller in order to be rich, but more like, oh, I need to be like this person because I really admire what they've done in life. And like, who inspires you? Who do you study? Who virtually taught you some of the things about yourself?
I mean, my biggest inspiration is David Bowie.
You mentioned him in context.
I talk about him all the time because I would study his interviews. I would look at, you know, how he constructs his music. And the fact that he was unabashedly who he was, and he was always reinventing himself with new ideas and new characters, which seems counterintuitive because if you're who you are, why do you have to add other layers? But he was always on a journey of self-discovery. And he, you know, I could never do it the same way he could, but he never cared what anyone thought. And when he started in the music business, you know, quick story, his first album, he was Dave Jones at that point. They wanted him to do folk music like Bob Dylan, because Bob Dylan was really popular. And he did a whole album of folk music that sold like 10 copies. And he went away and studied in a Buddhist monastery, did experimental arts. He became a mime. He did all this weird shit that David Bowie would do. Then he came back and started writing music for himself. And that's the David Bowie that we know now. And that to me is like proof point of don't do what other people are telling you to do. And they want you to be in this nice box that can sell. But if you're true to who you are and go find yourself, you're going to become one of the best recording artists of all time, possibly. And that to me, I always stay true to that, because in business, in life, people want to put you in the box that's comfortable for them, and you're never going to succeed that way. I mean, you talk about that in your work all the time.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate you saying that. And what's a time when you felt like you were persuading where you weren't yourself? Like, what set you on the trajectory of, you know what, I gotta do this right. I'm not gonna do this the BS way. I'm gonna do this right. Were you always this way, or like, was there a moment where, not necessarily a moment, but did you ever, was there a bad persuasion that, that kind of woke you up a little bit?
There was, you know, there's probably been like different times in my life, but I was, you know, in business early on in the company, I was persuaded to, start, remember when Vine was popular?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I was persuaded.
You talk about Vine.
Yeah. I talk about that in there, but that to me was like a business case where I was like, all right, I'm not going to try to go for a get rich quick scheme or do something that in my gut, I don't believe in, or I don't value. And, you know, we created this like search engine for Vine. We spent a ton of company resources. Other people had persuaded me and convinced me that we were going to flip it and sell it to Twitter for a ton of money. Cause if you remember Vine, you can never really search for videos very well. And then we launched the product, and then a week later they killed Vine. And I was like, I just spent all this fucking money. And this product, I didn't even like Vine to begin with. It wasn't something that was true to me. And I realized you should never spend money or invest in things that you don't really believe in, they're not true to who you are or what you believe or that you think will be successful. And that was a really hard lesson. And I never did that again.
Well, and there's so many reasons behind that as well, because A, whenever you start any business, you have to be able to validate the idea. And who better to validate the idea than if you're building the business that you would use? If you wouldn't use it, you need other resources. You need to spend energy now validating the idea. But if you are obsessed with Vine and you totally would use this, and this is what Vine users have been waiting for, and you know that deep down, you don't need to validate the idea. You just validated it.
Because then it would be true to who I was. But I did something that I didn't care for, didn't. And so there's a couple instances where that I got talked into something that I really didn't believe in, or, you know, maybe sold an ad or advertising product or an idea to a client that I didn't really believe in my gut, that, you know, didn't move the needle. It didn't work. So I really quickly in my career stopped doing that. If I don't believe in it, I can't sell it, and I'm not going to back it.
Yeah. Like, I remember one time, I was pre your agency, but I had a small agency. I was selling Philip Morris, the cigarette company. Philip Morris owned Kraft, and they were also the Kraft cheese company and the Philip Morris cigarette company. And so I remember I go to the meeting, and it's in a conference room right on 41st and 40 or 42nd and Park maybe. And everybody's around the conference room smoking, around the table smoking, and there's a plates of cheese cubes in the middle. And I hate cheese with a passion, and I don't smoke.
God.
And here I am, and I don't believe people should smoke, and I personally would never recommend cheese to anybody. And here I am selling my hardest to get this client. And it just, maybe that's why I really hated that business, because I don't think I was ever myself when I was doing that business.
Did you sell what you were selling? Did they buy it?
Yes, they bought it.
Wow. That's unusual, because usually people have really good bullshit detectors and they could tell you, well, I don't know, you somehow fooled them.
No, but you know what it was, is that I believed in the internet. And this was the mid-90s when not everyone did believe in that and not everyone had a website. And so I was able to passionately talk about that. And most of my other clients actually were music labels and movie studios. And I did believe in that and the internet. So that was much better for me.
That made sense, yeah.
But the companies like Philip Morris or American Express, I didn't care about those companies at all, but they were big clients, so I did whatever it took to get them. But I felt really, really bad about myself. I mean, I had to see a therapist because I felt like I didn't... It's like that classic Charlie Sheen cliched line from Wall Street, like, I don't know who I am anymore. I was really, felt really bad. But one technique, which I know you would resonate with this, is that when I was pitching a client, I could often think of better agencies they should use. And I was always free about saying what other agencies they should use. What were the good qualities of other agencies that were competitors of mine? And I said, I'm still running for the business because I love your business. But if you need this, this, and this, these other agencies are better than me. And that turned out to be inadvertently a good persuasion technique. If he's willing to recommend his competitors, he's a kind of guy I want to deal with.
It's true. Well, people hate the word no. you know, the word no is like the sexiest word in the English language. So if you're, yeah. if you're like, no, don't hire me, all of a sudden they want to know why they want to hire you.
Why doesn't every ad start with "Don't buy us, we don't want you"?
yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know, I noticed with stand-up comedy, actually, a lot of like great comedians, the first thing they do is insult the audience. And the comedians who are more amateurish or beginning, and I see all types because I own a club. The more amateurish ones pander to the audience and get them, but the ones who just shit all over the audience, they're instantly far more likable than the ones who pander.
They like that comic better.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. And then, you know, another thing that I firmly believe in is that I think is a learned skill is storytelling. Right. And storytelling to me is a very useful persuasion technique, but it also relates to you getting to know who you are. You know, that's a technique, whether it's movies you love and why, or books that you've read and why you like that story. I think having stories at hand to tell is a real strength in influencing other people. And when you think of like, I don't know, storytelling through the ages, the most noted people in our culture were always great storytellers. They didn't use facts and data, they use story to get their message across. And so storytelling, I think, can be another learned skill.
And I also believe in this very strongly, like any concept, I think this is why academic papers are so dry and why many scientists hate people who write popular science books. Like the scientists who are able to write popular science books, because those ones are able to tell stories and that makes them a lot more money. But right. what's an example where you've used storytelling in persuasion?
So, the psychologist, Jonathan Haidt.
Yeah.
He always said that the mind is a story processor, not a logic processor, which I always like think about that. And I think about that all the time. But I mean, I use stories to get people at my company to believe in collaboration. And I'll use stories from the business world or experiences that I've had. So I talk about it in the book, one time when we pitched Walt Disney, we lost that pitch. And I use that as a metaphor for preparing when you're meeting with clients or pitching a deal. And the story was, it was me and my other partner that we started the business together, Tommy Means. We went to Disney. We had a huge pitch. We were pitching the head of Parks and Resorts, and we created these characters because, you know, the Disney Imagineers, not a lot of people know who they are. They create all the parks themes and the, you know, the Imagineers, you're familiar with them? Yeah. Okay. Of course you are. And so we created a way to unlock kids' imagination by creating, bringing the Imagineers to life. And we had Rock and Block that would build the park, and we had Spark that would come up with the ideas, and Fable that would write it.
I could tell you instantly they're not going to accept this idea.
Okay. Well,
because it's not true to who Disney is.
Well, they actually love the idea.
Really? All right, I'm wrong.
And we had a partnership with Scholastics, and we were trying to make the Imagineers well known with kids so that they could dream of jobs maybe one day that they would have. And it was obviously a revenue maker for Disney because there'd be all kinds of merchandise. And so we went to China and created these characters based on the characters that I just told you. And we met with the head of Parks and Resorts, and we presented our whole thing. And he said, you know, the first thing he said was, I love this idea. And just so you know, because you presented it to us, we own it. And we want to work with you on it, but there's only one thing we want to tweak. I don't like the characters you developed. My partner, who's on the other side of the table, in my mind, I'm like, no problem. We'll just tell him, like, who are we to tell Disney that they can't develop characters, and we're an advertising agency. We're better at developing characters than Disney. No, but my foot couldn't reach under the table to kick him. And before I could get his attention, he said, well, these are the characters, you know, take it or leave it.
Oh my God. Well, can I ask you a question? Why would he say that? Because the reason I had that gut instinct that I had was Disney spends billions of dollars creating characters. Like, they'll spend $6 billion for Pixar's characters. They're only buying the characters. They're not, I mean, yeah, they're buying a backlog, but They're really thinking about the future.
Buying the yeah, right. Yeah, but we had the concept of how to get it in schools and create a we did have a lot to offer, but as soon as he said that, you know, the guy got up and left, and his whole like minion of note takers left with him in a cloud of like a cartoon cloud of dust, and that was it. And what we ended up getting drunk at a Burbank bar. And I use that as story for the agency to say, you have to prepare before you have a pitch of what questions will be asked. You have to collaborate with your partner to make sure you're on the same page with what you're going to say yes to and what you're going to say no to. And we just rushed in with all this stuff without preparation and without collaborating. And we had a deal that at the time for our agency would have been huge, millions of dollars, and we lost it. And so that's a storytelling technique to say, prepare and collaborate. And I use that all the time when I'm talking to employees here. So that's an example of a storytelling.
I think this is an important insight that people need to listen to, because I love Robert Cialdini. I love his book Influence. I think he presents some really great overriding concepts, and also his book Persuasion, some overriding concepts and a lot of great research about persuasion. But at its heart, I'm not going to persuade you of anything if you hate me, or it's going to be much more difficult. And so storytelling is like this bridge that we're able to, our personality rides over it to the other person. That's how we get, that's the only way to get to know each other. If all you know is like, I'm 5'9" and I went to this school and this is my IQ, where you don't know anything about me. It's only through stories.
Only through stories, totally. And storytelling is how you, and it can be stories from your life. It could be stories of, impactful events that have happened that mean something to you. But having a collection of these stories express who you are. That's a way of connecting with other people. And so, story, but it can be a learned skill. You can learn how to tell stories and role models also help. Why do I like David Bowie? I can tell you that story and you can learn a little bit about me from that. So it's part of being original in who you are. Storytelling is a critical key. And if you're doing, any type of data or presenting, like you talked about scientists, if you're presenting results from any of your work and you bypass the story and you just go into data and numbers without a story, no one's going to remember it. It's not sticky. Stories are sticky and numbers aren't.
Yeah. Like you look at like Einstein, he essentially persuaded the world of the general theory of relativity, right? Because it was a theory for a reason. He couldn't prove it. I mean, there wasn't data for decades on anything related to what he was talking about, but he presents it with a story. What if you're on the ground and another person's in a spaceship going at the speed of light? What do you guys see of each other? And then he's able to use that to kind of describe the theory. I still don't understand what the theory of relativity is, but I understand that story.
Yeah, but you remember Einstein.
Yeah, Einstein, because he, and not only that, his whole look was a story. And it wasn't a calculated look. It was just, he looked like the cliche of a genius, or that became a cliche of genius after him. I don't know.
Right.
But I like these rules that you have. And I'll read them. Never sell anything you wouldn't buy yourself. And we discussed that a little bit, but there's a lot of reasons for that. It's not only that it's inauthentic to sell something you wouldn't buy yourself. It's that you can understand it better if you love the product enough to buy it yourself. Don't be afraid to say no. We discussed that a little bit. And I think a lot of people I'm afraid to say no often, which is why I even wrote a book about it. Never let relationships drop to zero. What do you mean by that?
So that is, that's sort of always been my approach in building a business. And I don't know if you approach relationships the same, but if you're pitching someone and you're investing time, and this is personal and business. If you're investing time to get to know someone and they turn you down and you don't get that business, you still created a connection, and that connection can wither away and you can never talk to that person again, or that connection can live on. And so if you're building that connection, you should always stay in touch with people. And you can stay in touch with people by sending them a text, sending them an article about something. If I know that you love NFTs and we connect, maybe I'll send you something about an NFT in 3 months to stay on your radar and not let our relationship drop to zero. And that's a simple but practical use of doing that.
Yeah, I was talking to Jeff Immelt the other day, who was the former CEO of GE for 16 years, and he said a similar thing, which is that we'll always spend time each day contacting people you don't need. People want to know you're not just calling them when you need something. And for him, that was a very authentic way to operate, and it worked. It served him well. That's a very powerful technique.
Yeah, so it's easy in business and in life to just march forward. And this idea, it's the same thing as, you know, I talk about never be closing and letting go of transactional thinking and thinking about your network and meaningful relationships as an approach, not as a zero-sum game of winning and losing and winning and losing and winning and losing, but connecting a network of people and building on those relationships. And that way you're never closing, you're just ever expanding. And I think that's really, you know, as an entrepreneur, how I see the world.
Related to this fact I heard about LinkedIn, which is that most people get job offers not from their LinkedIn connections, but the connections of connections. So it's like, but what you're saying is basically keep in touch with the connections, you know, and keep working on, like, never be closing, always working on those relationships. They might not have a job for you, but if you're the one who's keeping in touch with them and now you need a job, you're using the whole brain power of your network. And that's why the friends of your friends are the ones that end up giving you the jobs.
Yeah, they'll maybe hear about a job and you'll be on the radar.
Yeah.
They'll reach out to you. There's a technique that I use in my calendar where I mark out 20 minutes every day and I plan it out on Sunday, 20 minutes of every day to reach out and connect to 3 people in my network.
That's important to schedule it. I should do that. I'm bad at keeping in touch with people, and that's a good idea.
But if you don't do it, then you'll be like, oh, I'll reach out to them at some point. But you never do. But if you make it sort of muscle memory and you only do it 5 days a week, 20 minutes, it's nothing. And you just think of something, some interest that they have, and you reach out to them and say, hey, I'm thinking about you. And you send them, you know, I know you're into Peloton. I saw this article. Boom. You know, I know you're a big Ben and Jerry's fan. They're coming out with a new flavor. Boom. And it just reminds them that you're thinking about them. And it seems sort of forced to schedule it. But like anything in our lives, if you don't set aside the time, you'll never get to it.
You know, and the fourth item you mentioned here is make sure you have some skin in the game. And this is a little bit of a reference to the Nassim Taleb's book called Skin in the Game, which is the idea that you make better decisions if you have something on the line. You're more aware of the risks if you have skin in the game, if you have like money invested in something or time or emotion or whatever. You know, describe how you mean it.
So really from a business standpoint, if I'm making a partnership with a brand and I want to have skin in the game. So I might say, you know, our fee is X, but I'll take this much off our fee and this much off our profit. And then in success, if we're successful together, I'll make that up on the other side. That makes me work twice as hard for that client because I have upside. I'm not just getting paid for my hours and time, but I have upside on the back end. And I feel like that goes hand in hand with anything in your life that's worthy of pursuing.
Let's say you're an employee and you go into your boss's office. I think this is the classic persuasion case. You want to convince your boss to give you a raise. How would you demonstrate skin in the game?
That's a great question. So, you know, I think I deserve to be promoted and at the next level and get this kind of bump. And your boss isn't quite sure or doesn't see it. You could say, all right, how about I take on this one detail or one function of what that new role would be, and I'll do it for 3 months. And you can tell me if you think I did it successfully or not. And then you do that. That's skin in the game. It's extra work for you. You're not getting paid for that extra work, but you're going in and doing it. 3 months later, you come back. It's going to be hard for that boss to say, well, I don't think you're ready or you don't deserve it. You've already performed this function virtually for free for your boss. And then your boss can say, yeah, you're right. You're ready to move on to the next level. That's one example off the top of my head. But I think that's you putting skin in the game and putting in extra hours to prove that you're worthy of that bump.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop. Really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
I always admire people who are great at what they do, because it's not easy to be great at something that's worth getting good at. In fact, it's extremely difficult. And someone who's done that shows me they have passion, shows me they know how to meta-learn, they know how to learn how to learn. And there's kind of just this aura of competence about them that I always admire. And you talk about it in the book, but describe how that's related to persuasion.
So, you know, I think there's two techniques in the soulful piece. So, you know, the book's broken into four basic principles: original, being yourself; generous, which is giving things away without expecting anything in return; empathetic, which is the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes; and then soulful. And those are the four principles that I feel make up my version of persuasion, or soulful persuasion. And the soulful part really has two elements. One is skill hunting, which you pointed out, which is really hunting out new skills around your passion to always be developing a proficiency in something new. You might be great at investing. You might be great at writing books. You might be great at advertising. That's awesome. But you also can learn, I don't know, how to cook, how to garden, how to box, how to do karate, how to play bass. Every 2 or 3 years, you should be adding on to your proficiency and never letting that lapse. I think no matter how old you get, you should always go through, remind yourself of that thing you always wanted to do. I know you love chess, right? You're a great chess player. I watch Queen's Gambit like the whole damn country. I started to learn how to play chess. That's like my new thing. And man, it's very hard, by the way.
I'll give you lessons. We'll get you.
All right, that'd be awesome.
I'm serious too, because I believe that just as Einstein said too, is that you can't understand anything unless you can explain it simply.
No one's been able to explain it simply, but that'd be great. I'd take you up on that. So, you know, that's my current thing, is I'm going to spend like 2 or 3 years trying to get moderately capable at chess, and then I'll move on to something else, but I'll still play chess. I did that with like learning the bass, learning to cook, et cetera. And so I think every couple of years, it's good practice to add new skills to your arsenal and to your tool belt. But you have to always, like right now I'm in the suck part. Like, I don't get it. I'm trying to read about it. I'm trying to calculate, you know, three moves ahead. And I'm in the part that sucks. Like, it's painful. You know, no one likes to be shitty at something. But I'm going through that suck to get to the other side and to turn around and say, you know, hey, I was able to get okay at chess.
But this is the great thing about learning almost anything, is that, and this is going to sound counterintuitive, but they all suck and they always suck. Chess never gets better. It always sucks. Some things get better, which is that you appreciate the nuances a lot more. It's one of those things, the more you know, the more you realize you need to know, and the more you appreciate, just like cooking, just like tennis, chess, math, whatever, business. But anything worth doing is going to suck most of the time, because as you move up, you're always competing against good competition. And as you get better, you're competing against better competition. And I just watched a video this morning of and I only say this because this is true in every industry. I watched a video of the strongest player in Canada lose a game because he made a blunder like anyone else. And he yelled a curse and threw a chair across the room. This is a guy who's the strongest player in Canada and has been a professional for 20 years.
What, do you enjoy playing it now, don't you?
Oh yeah, I love it. Yeah, but it sucks when you lose. And if you lose, like let's say you're winning a game the entire time and then you just make a shitty mistake at the end, that is just the worst feeling. Cause when you're creating a masterpiece, this is, and you're thinking about, this is how I'm going to explain it to people. Like, it's so great. It's like, there's going to be books written about this game. And then you just like drop your queen for no reason. And you're just like, oh,
that, I didn't see that coming. Yeah.
This was the Bible for me. And now it's like just a bad pamphlet. Like, it's nothing.
That's a bad pamphlet. But yeah, I mean, I've been learning how to box for like 4 years. That was like a new skill for me. And I thought, you know, there's six punches. Like, how hard can it be to learn that skill? And you realize with anything, even something with six punches or chess with like infinite moves you can make, it's infinitely complicated. Like, you'll never, it's very hard to master those new skills, but the learning and the development and the way it wires your brain, that's like incredibly useful, but it makes you more influential and more persuasive that every couple of years you dig into something new, because very few people do that. So I think skill hunting is an important thing for people to get with.
Explain why, because it's not like you're trying to persuade people about boxing. What is it about the process of learning a new skill, good enough to be, let's say, above average at it? What is it about that that makes someone more influential, more persuasive?
You know, anytime you're learning a skill, it tweaks slightly how you see the world from the thing that you're learning. And I think the fact that you're even doing it, I think, is inspirational to people that you're even trying to master something hard and new when most people wouldn't really try to learn a new skill. But I also think every skill that you develop, there's some new element of how you see the world or how you approach things. It also gives you confidence in yourself that you can go through the suck and get out the other side and repeat that. And I think that makes you, you know, I don't know how to measure it or put it in a bottle. It's a vibe. It makes you more influential and more inspirational to other people.
I think also it makes you more confident. And
right.
You know, you talk about positivity in the book too. To be great at something, you have to be positive through the suck. You have to be able to think, okay, I suck now, but I know if I apply these principles of learning and I put the time in, I'm going to be good at this. And that's a positive framework. It's you know, a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset.
That's right. And it also makes you stick with something, right? It makes you not quit. It makes you comfortable with sucking or failing or losing, but then sticking it through to get to the other side. So I think those are other skills that it develops. And I think once you've got a successful career, once you maybe have some money or financial means, and you're not going through the suck and you're not learning new skills, there you are at a fixed mindset, right?
Yeah.
You're like, okay, I mastered this thing. I did really well at it. I was successful, and that's it. You know, and maybe you'll loosely try to consult or do other things on the side, but you're not really challenging yourself.
You've lost that grit somehow.
You lost that grit. And skill hunting, I love that. I should have written down the book, but you lost that grit. Skill hunting brings back that grit. It brings you down a notch so that you can get better and get better. And then the other part of there's skill hunting, and then there's this idea of being inspiring or soulful and doing something for other people. So that's the other part to me of being soulful, a soulful persuader, is trying to give back to the world, your community, the culture in some way. Taking a skill that you have and giving back by doing something beyond yourself, you know, doing something that you're doing not for money, not for monetary gain, not for fame, but purely because you want to do it. It's pure philanthropy that doesn't involve donating money. It's your time, your energy to help other people. That to me makes you way more influential, way more persuasive, and more of an inspiration.
I agree, but why is that? Like, what's happening there? Connect the dots a little bit. And also, I just want to add, it seems like there's two types of giving. So there's the giving that's like, okay, I'm cleaning up the streets on the weekends. I'm doing this. I'm giving up my time. And then there's giving directly to the people in your circle or the people you're persuading. So I'm giving ideas for free, or I'm giving, in the example of persuasion with the boss, you're giving you know, you'll do your more time work for free. Yeah,
that's not what I'm talking about. I mean, I do believe in, from a business standpoint, like when we started, I think the first year, we did all of our work for free to build up case studies so that we had big brands like Microsoft and other brands associated with us so that we could go get paying brands. And that's one thing, but that's still building a business. There's nothing soulful about that. That's more strategic, right? Mm-hmm. That's more like, okay, that's smart. Or the Boss example is a strategic play. What I'm talking about is, you would say that your soulful thing right now, I'm putting words in your mouth, is the choose yourself concept and getting people to change their lives, right?
Yeah.
That's the thing that you're doing that is soulful, but it's also a business and you're making money off of it and you're selling books. And so that's one benefit. Maybe you would take that idea or that concept or that skill you have and do workshops, and maybe you're doing this, I don't know. You're doing workshops or speaking engagements or one-on-one to people for free. Or
yeah, I'm doing exactly that.
Oh, you are? Okay. Well, that was a guess. But that is you're more inspirational and influential because you're doing that for free to help other people without expecting any money, no monetary gain. You're not selling books. You're doing that because you purely have an idea and you want people to have the best life that they can.
But how does, like, since in general, nobody knows what I do on that hand, that's part of giving. How does that translate into more persuasion ability?
Well, it would translate if you let people know you were doing it.
Yeah. So, but I don't let people know I'm doing it. So I like.
Why don't you want people to know?
There's really not good ways to transmit what you do privately to help people. And not that I never seek those ways out, because maybe there is no ways. I don't know. Like on Kickstarter or whatever, you could say, oh, or GoFundMe, I could say, oh, I donated to this. Or you could be anonymous. And, you know, I always think it's a back and forth. Sometimes if your friends are aware that you're giving to something, they're more likely to give. There's research on that. But other times it seems like it's more of a, in Judaism you say, is more of a mitzvah if you do it anonymous.
Well, I think you can broadcast that you're a mensch. You know, that's my philosophy is I agree you should do that stuff, but you should talk about it. And you should talk about it because you want everyone patting yourself on the back. You talk about it because you want to inspire other people to do the same thing. So if you're doing that, but no one knows about it, then are other authors that have a skill that they can give people to help turn their life around? They'll be like, well, James doesn't do that. Why should I do that? But if you're doing it, maybe it'll inspire other people to do it. So I think you should always talk about it. And brands, same way with brands, like, you know, Warby Parker, they don't hide that they give away glasses to parts of the world where they can't afford glasses. They use it as a, well, we get one, give one model. Or Patagonia, that, you know, is fighting climate change. They don't hide that, tuck that away. They talk about it and that becomes part of their brand. And Patagonia is a more influential brand because they talk about the money they give away and what they do and their causes. I think that's the same for people as a brand. And we should do it. And you'd be surprised at how many people don't do anything like that, you know?
Yeah, no, you're right. I think everybody gets, particularly, we live in a very fast age. And so people get so caught up in the hierarchy that they're in and their money situation and the responsibilities that they lose track of the fact that we live in this bigger world that you need to contribute to, I think. And, you know, I don't know if I totally agree that strategic giving is different from giving, because I run into a lot of people who say, oh, I'm not going to give so-and-so my ideas. What if they steal them? I'm always in favor of give everyone all your ideas, because then it encourages in yourself a feeling of abundance. There's no one idea that's going to make or break you, that if someone steals your idea, that's okay. It's validation. And you move on to your many other ideas. And I think that can make one more persuasive, just knowing that you're the source of ideas.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good thing if you're giving, but maybe that's your gift, right? You freely give ideas to people without expecting anything.
Yeah.
Maybe that's your gift. The way I toggle between this soulful idea and the skill hunting is really for your personal mindset, and soulfulness is really for the benefit of the world and for other people around you. And so that's the difference. And it's usually around, you have to be giving away the soulful piece based on a skill you have. Like I do a lot of pro bono, my skill is advertising. So I do a lot of pro bono advertising campaigns for, you know, Red Nose Day and the UN, and we'll give away our time and resources and energy. You know, we're working on a vaccine campaign now. So we'll give that stuff away in order to help a greater good or a greater cause. But that's the main skill that I have. You know, yours might be, you might have investing advice or whatever, or the whole choose yourself, trying to get people to live the best life they can. That part that you're giving away is the thing you're most skilled at. Oh, so I have a example of how this pays off and how this makes you an influential person. A friend of mine was a hair cutter in London. His name's Josh Combs. And he was like, you know, and this happened to me when in advertising, I'm like, that's it. Like, I'm just going to make ads. Like, then I started doing my skill for good, and it reinvigorated me in my career. And he was the same way. He was cutting hair. He's like, I guess I'm a hairdresser. I'm a barber. Then he started going on the streets of London and cutting homeless people's hair. And then that was at his lunch break. Then he did it every lunch break. Then he would take a day a week off and do it. Then he would take a week a month off, do it. Then he would travel around the world and, you know, take pictures of before and after. He would talk to homeless people, who he would make them feel dignity and feel different, and like someone was there trying to help him, help them become a little bit better. And then he turned that into speaking about it and writing a book about it, and turned it into a career. So he took a skill of cutting hair, turned it into being inspirational and building a new platform for himself off of it. So, you know, if an ad man can do it and a barber can do it, anyone can do it. You know, that's how I look at it.
That story is in your book, and it's a beautiful story. I think it's finding those, it's almost like you have to find your niche in giving as well. Like if you just donate to a charity and host a ball or whatever, or a fundraiser, that's great, of course. But so, and that's what feels like the average philanthropist or active philanthropy is, but it's really not. Like you kind of have to find your own unique voice, even in giving.
Yeah, that's right. And it's usually from some skill that you have. Yeah, I mean, you could teach, you could teach chess to underprivileged kids.
Yeah, I mean, the good thing is there are a lot of educational programs for underprivileged on chess for underprivileged kids, because it's sort of documented that kids who study chess end up doing better in school and jobs later on in life. So that's actually, there's probably more underprivileged kids learning chess than privileged kids, even though it's thought of as this sort of stodgy, privileged kind of game.
Yeah, yeah. Awesome.
You know, and all of these techniques in your book, they're not techniques. This is sort of how one should live life. And then you create this aura of influence and persuasion around you. And that's what, I think that's what makes a leader.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So this really becomes, for me, this becomes more a book about leadership than, hey, I'm going to convince you to hire me, or I'm going to convince my boss for a raise. Although those things can happen as well. Leaders could lead from behind. So you could start off in your career and still be a leader.
Yeah, but I think there are techniques for a way to approach the world. I think it's personal and business, really. It kind of blends. But I think it does. These are leadership qualities that will make you successful, or help make you successful. But I didn't set out with a plan like, okay, I'm going to do these four things, and this is my plan, and that's how I'm going to be successful. It's how I ended up operating that I then categorized as these skills that, you know, hopefully other people can learn from.
How did you pitch this book? Like, how did you convince them to give you a book deal, in the sense that, like, let's say I'm the agent or the publisher or whoever you were pitching, and I say, okay, Jason, I heard of your agency. You do great stuff. Clearly, you know about persuasion because you've gotten a bunch of clients and everything. But I've already published like 10 books about persuasion in the past 2 years. I'm almost, maybe you can write a book about that Disney story instead, or something like that. Like, what did you encounter when you were pitching this book?
Well, I was published through Penguin Random House. I had a really great editor. I'd never written a book before, and I don't know if this happened in your Harper Collins deal, but my book was more about entrepreneurship and how to things that I think make you a successful entrepreneur in starting a business. And what happens, it's very much like the entertainment business. You get an editor and your editor says, well, that book is like, has this narrow audience. You need to reach this many people to have a successful best-selling book. So we have to open it up to be about business, you know, writ large, and about being a better person, not just how do you, skills you need for an entrepreneur. And so that's how it developed. I took the same principles, but I made it, I opened the aperture to me about any business and persuasion in general, not about persuasion in the entrepreneur sense, but the same four principles were there to start with. I don't know if you encountered that. They always try to make it broader and broader.
Yeah, sometimes it's there's a balance, because sometimes if you try to be everything to everybody, you end up being nothing to nobody, or nothing to everybody, rather.
Yeah.
You know, but the title for my book, and even Choose Yourself, went through a couple of iterations before. The title's hard, because people say don't judge a book by its cover, but there's actually no other way to judge a book. So you only see its cover at first, and you only see the title, and then you have to decide your first decision, which is whether to pick it up or not.
I think title is everything.
Yeah. Title sometimes cover, if the cover is really good.
Yeah.
Cover's good, but the title's great. It's a great title.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I don't think Choose Yourself could be any clearer.
No, and I like Choose Yourself because it was a call to action, and people respond to that. Or if you make up a word like Freakonomics or the 4-hour work week, like if you make up a concept that, or, you know, that becomes yours, then, and Choose Yourself was a little bit like that as well. But I also validated the idea in a sense by, I put up Facebook ads of several different book titles and saw which ones were getting the most clicks.
Oh, that's really smart. You did some A/B testing early on.
Yeah.
I like that.
So one more question, just in general about advertising. I see all these ads and they're so boring. Like I'll see, I won't name any specific company, but let's say I'll see a phone company advertising about 5G and everybody's standing in line and the person with 1G is not happy. The person with 5G is very happy. This is so boring. Why doesn't someone like ever, you know, really step out of the box and do something that's really noticeable, as opposed to an ad that you're just not going to remember. No one's going to remember this ad. The only reason I remember it was because I was astonished how boring it was.
Well, I think like all business, when you're doing well and you're printing money, the risk is too great to do something, you know, extraordinary. When you're a challenger brand, like just starting, you have no choice. You know, you have to stand out. You have to say something. You can't be wallpaper. And that's when the best advertising comes, is when you're in a massive decline and your business is like on the way out and you need a resurgence, or you're just starting out and you have to get famous fast. And that's when the best advertising comes. A lot of those companies, they're doing fine. The ad's just like a little slice of memory, like, hey, we're AT&T, we're Verizon. You know, we're still here. That's all it is like, we're still here. And you don't have to swing for the fences and, you know, strike out. You're just here. It's just like constant layer, which I agree. I hate that advertising, but that's a lot of it's like that. And that's because those companies are printing money.
I guess that's right. Like the we're still here concept versus the if I was making an ad, I would think, wouldn't you want your viewer, let's say it's a TV ad, wouldn't you want your viewer to say, I can't believe they just did that. They just did that. That's what I would think they were thinking. But I guess you're right that for them, it's important not to think that way. The we're still here is very important for them.
Yeah. Like we just did an ad on the Golden Globes for a company called Freedom Mom, which is a breastfeeding company for new moms. And we showed the team that did it, which was all female team, absolutely crushed the concept and the ad. And it was actually showing the struggles and the hardships and what a pain it is to learn how to breastfeed. and that this company's here to help you. And we actually got NBC to show on the Golden Globes, you know, females breastfeeding, which was against their standards. But that's a way to take a relatively unknown company and be noticed and get coverage and go for the go big. And so that's an example of how to do it.
Well, like obviously one of the most famous commercials ever is the 1984 Apple commercial. It only aired once during the 1984 Olympics, and it doesn't even mention the word Apple in it.
Yeah.
And so that's an example of them trying to communicate who they authentically are. Like they're the rebellious young upstart against
the George Orwellian future. And
it's also very giving in that they have so much confidence. I mean, giving in the strategic sense, and that they appear to have so much confidence in themselves, they don't even need to say what their name is.
I know. And that's when they had no choice. They had to have everyone looking up Apple, right? Like that's why they did that ad. And it made a massive, massive impact.
Has anyone done a book of, and this is just a side thing, has anyone done a book of like the 100 greatest ad campaigns of all time and then analyzing and breaking them down?
No.
You should do that book. It sounds like a fun book.
It should be a fun book. Don't tell me it's too narrow.
Yeah. But you know, it would be a textbook though too. So you would sell a lot just by virtue of that.
That's a good, I like the way you think.
Yeah, there you go. Look, Jason Harris.
Well, you stole my next book idea. So maybe you just gave me one too.
Yeah, right. You have that one. I won't write it. Jason Harris, The Soulful Art of Persuasion, The 11 Habits That Will Make Anyone a Master Influencer. It's really true. I've experienced these techniques myself, and it was so great to see you put names and a process and a system around them. And it's a great book about persuasion, and which is on a topic that I also love and read lots of books on, and I super enjoyed this one.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on. I'm going to take you up on that chess lesson.
Anytime. We'll schedule it. And, you know, I believe in this learning technique that was explained to me by Frank Shamrock, who was a 10-year world mixed martial arts champion. He always had to learn new martial arts. So he had a technique called plus minus equal. And you find a plus, which is someone to teach you, and it could be virtual or real. You find equals, people who are at your level, who are rising up and passionate, and you challenge each other. And then you find a minus, which is a negative way to say it, but it's you find people who
someone
you can
beat.
Well, someone you can explain to, yes. Okay. You should be able to beat them too. But someone you can explain concepts to. So, and I find, because since the Queen's Gambit came out, I'm studying chess for the first time in 23 years. I haven't taken a lesson in 23 years. And your skills decrease they atrophy the way muscles do. My skills are 50% of what they were when I was at my peak in 1997. But I now am using all these techniques to get almost as an experiment to see if the techniques I write about work. But I'm getting better than I ever was. My goal is to get not only as good as I was at chess in 1997, but much, much better. And when I give lessons, and I have a couple of people I give lessons to now, I see basic concepts in a completely different light than I ever have before. And then I notice them come up in my games now because I gave them as a lesson. I sometimes learn more from the lessons I give than the lessons I take.
That's awesome. Well, I'll be your minus.
Excellent. Let me know when and we'll schedule it.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, Jason. Yeah. Talk to you soon.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.